parasites. To most people, they're simply revolting.
Gut worms came out of somebody. About 5 or 6 different worms.
Even the word parasite is an insult.
How disgusting do you find that on a scale of 1 to 10?
Disgusting they may be, but I think they're also truly extraordinary. They have astonishing life cycles, and they are some of the most successful creatures on the planet. To find out more about these amazing animals, I'm going to deliberately infest myself with a range of parasites.
It's like jumping off a cliff. Here we go.
He swallows something.
From the largest to the most deadly.
By becoming a host, I'm hoping to discover how the human body, this body, responds to parasite infection.
I'm going to use my infestations to study firsthand our complex relationship with parasites.
Ah!
Experience the costs and potential benefits of being infested. And even find out what they can tell us about our own origins.
BBC Infested, Living with Parasites. Presented by Michael Mosley. A city street lined with trees in lilac blossom.
My first of many encounters with parasites starts here in Nairobi, Kenya.
Michael's in a 4x4.
I'm in search of an extraordinary human parasite, one which has been all but eliminated in the developed world.
Now, most tourists come to Kenya in search of wildlife. Just down the road from here, you can go to a safari park where you will see rhino and giraffes. I, however, have come in search of something smaller and much less attractive, tapeworm.
The tapeworm is one of nature's most successful parasites.
A whale.
There are thousands of different species of tapeworm, each adapted to a particular host.
A rat, then a rhino.
The one I'm looking for is Tinea saginata, the beef tapeworm. It's evolved to live in our guts. But its peculiar life cycle also involves cattle.
So imagine you're in rural Kenya and you've got a great big tapeworm inside you. This tapeworm is producing eggs. One day you go down to a field and you excrete there and you contaminate the grass. Then along comes a poor, unfortunate cow who eats that grass.
Tapeworm eggs in their feed.
Along with grass, the cow eats the tapeworm eggs, which hatch into larvae, and then enter the cow's bloodstream.
Spreads through the blood to the muscle, perhaps the shoulders or the tongue. And there it forms a really tough cyst. And it hangs around just waiting for the next stage, which is for the cow to be eaten by a human.
A braying cow.
The beef tapeworm can only grow to adulthood inside a human, and for that reason, it's hard to study. So I've decided to infest myself as my contribution to research into these shy, retiring creatures. So I need to find infected beef.
But in Britain, it's extremely unlikely you'll find a contaminated cow, which is why I've come to Kenya.
Passing roadside shacks.
But even here, tapeworm is getting harder to find as hygiene improves. To help me, I've teamed up with parasitology researcher Judy Mwangi.
Kind of felt like a good idea when we were planning this, but now we're actually doing it. It seems quite strange. Have you ever done anything like this before?
Oh, no, I haven't.
Scavengers sifting through rubbish.
We've had a tip-off that a meat inspector has found some infected beef. But to collect it, we need to drive into one of Nairobi's tougher neighbourhoods.
A run-down area.
It looks quite a rough area out there. Oof. So what happens now? Do we go to the slaughterhouse?
No, we cannot walk to the slaughterhouse. We have to wait for him to come and bring us the sample.
Okay. Yes. So he's definitely got a sample, is he?
He has now.
Okay.
Right. Been lucky.
Lucky. I was kind of hoping you were going to say, no, tragically, they haven't found anything. Mm. And will they let me into the slaughterhouse?
No, they will not. They're very sensitive about such issues.
Okay, and what about filming? Presumably they won't.
That is a definite no-no.
Traffic fumes cast a haze over a dusty street. A slab of meat is slapped onto a worktop.
Now we've got infected meat. We take it to the lab so Judy can find the tapeworm cysts.
So this is a cyst?
This is a cyst, yes.
It's not all I was expecting. I was expecting something quite hard. And this is quite jelly-like, isn't it?
It is jelly-like because if it's hard, it's calcified, so it's not viable.
I'm not particularly keen on eating raw meat. So Judy is cutting away as much tissue as possible, just leaving the tapeworm cyst itself.
It kind of looks like a partly fried egg, doesn't it?
It does, sunny side up.
Mm.
Inside this cyst is a tiny living tapeworm larva. It's what I've come all the way to Kenya for. And Judy has found three of them.
Is that the right sort of number?
I think so. One looks a bit dodgy.
So one's a bit dodgy, two of them you think are okay.
Yes.
And that kind of hopefully just increases the risk one of them will take.
Yes, indeed.
What happens if two of them take?
The better.
better for whom? Can I?
Yes.
Can I offer you one?
No, you're all right.
Later.
Back at the hotel, the time has come for me to give myself tapeworm.
I'm feeling mildly apprehensive. I think I'm confident that it should be safe. It is a very strange thought that there are millions of people who are infected by parasites who don't want to be, and I'm about to deliberately infect myself. But I hope it's not something I'm going to regret. Cheers.
He swirls the water in a jar.
It's like jumping over a cliff. Here we go.
Then swallows the contents.
Ah! There they go.
Bubbling gastric juices.
In just a few seconds, the tapeworm cysts are in my stomach. That's full of acids that normally help protect us from disease. But the tapeworm uses our defenses to its advantage. The acids dissolve the outer case of the cyst, releasing the worm inside, which then passes into my intestines looking for a home.
My time in Kenya is over now. I've done what I needed to do. Now to go home.
Michael climbs into the 4x4. In an animation, a picture of a cyst works its way down Michael's body, then rips in half.
If they survive, each cyst will release a tapeworm scolex, equipped with four suckers, which it will use to latch onto my guts. Then it starts to grow. New segments emerging from the scolex.
The segmented worm.
As it grows, the segments will get bigger and more mature, whilst new segments appear near the head. And I'll then use a miniature pill camera to see what's actually growing inside me. All this is only possible inside the human body. This particular tapeworm is so perfectly adapted to the exact conditions of the human gut that it can't grow anywhere else.
A tangle of threads resembling white tagliatelle.
That degree of specialization may seem bizarre, but it's actually common in parasites. There's a type of flatworm that can only live inside the lens of a stickleback's eye. And a mite that only lives inside a moth's ear.
Boots walking across a hard floor.
And perhaps the strangest example of extreme specialisation turned up here at the Horniman Museum in South London. One morning, someone brought them something they'd found in their fish supper.
They basically brought us someone's evening meal on a plate. So it was a cooked fish that the person had started to eat.
Halfway through their meal, they discovered this inside the fish's mouth. It was enough to put anyone off their food.
So this is Cymotherae exigua, the fish tongue louse, and it has a really unusual parasitic lifestyle. It enters the gills of the fish and then attaches to the tongue-like structure of the fish and kind of clings on and pierces the tongue structure with its big claws, and then basically feeds off the blood of the tongue, which eventually just becomes quite shriveled and ends up being just a little stump that the fish tongue louse then moves further into the mouth and basically starts to live as if it was the tongue of the fish. So manipulating food around the mouth.
The fish tongue louse is a particularly extreme example of a parasite that's adapted its body to fit its host's anatomy. But we also have parasites that have adapted to fit in with us, including lice. We have no fewer than three species of lice. And the story of how these three species evolved can tell us something remarkable about our own evolution.
A microscopic view of human hair.
The most familiar human louse is the head louse.
A louse clinging to a single strand.
To see its unique characteristics, I need my second infestation. So I'm off to a de-lousing salon in North London.
So to remove the head louse, we use a normal hoover with a specialist attachment, so it's got a comb on the end of it there. And then we collect the lice in the filter.
Great.
So you
okay.
Can have...
That's yeah. Good, because I actually want live.
Okay.
So I'm hoping there's going to be a few to... Yeah.
Well, I'm sure there will
be. We should see. Okay. Are you at all worried they're going to jump onto you?
They don't jump and they don't fly. The only way they move is by crawling, so... Yeah. If I put my head next to hers,
right, then they pull across. Yeah.
Or
you're well protected.
I am well protected. Yeah.
I'm less well protected.
If, unfortunately, you are infested, you will probably have 10 to 20 live lice on your head. But there can be hundreds.
So, good collection of head lice here.
Yeah.
Ooh, they're scuttling around.
There's some young adults, there's some babies that have just hatched, so.
They're pretty big. What I'd love you to do then is infect me, please. It's rather unusual, not your normal line of business.
I can do that.
Head lice can only survive by drinking human blood, which they do several times a day. To keep these lice alive, I need to feed them on me.
This could be my first.
These little pots should keep them safe while allowing them to bite me.
Thank you very much for infecting
You're
me.
You're welcome.
There aren't many people who would be pleased to hear their visitor is infested with lice.
Hi, James.
Hello.
I come bearing gifts.
Oh, excellent.
But James Logan is clearly delighted.
Let's have a look. Let's get... Oh, that's brilliant.
James studies lice and other parasites at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine.
OK, so here we have one. Mm-hmm. Shall we put it on your arm?
Why not? See if he scurries around.
Yeah, so I'm going
to Using a handheld microscope, we can study my head louse as it settles in.
But you can really see the blood here, can't you? So this one's quite recently fed on your blood. But you can see it being sort of pumped down here through its gut.
Like all lice, the head louse has retractable mouthparts that can puncture my skin. But what really surprised me is how active they can be.
It's going so fast I can't keep up with it.
This one's quite active, isn't it?
It certainly is. Look at that, it's gone right to the last hair on your arm. Look at it clinging on to the edge of that hair with two of its claws.
Look at those claws,
And it's got another claw out like this, and I wonder whether it's just sat there waiting for another host to come past.
So if I were to rub my head against yours, it would just grab a hold of your hair with the other claws and it would be across in an instant, would it?
Exactly right, yeah. It's on your arm, which is not the right place for a head louse. So it is probably sitting there thinking, I'm not in the right place, this isn't the right environment, and I want to be somewhere where there's more hair.
Head lice are well adapted to manoeuvring around the human scalp. their claws the right size for the hairs on our head. But there's another species that makes its home on human hair, the pubic louse. The good news is that pubic lice are increasingly hard to find. When we did finally get hold of these live specimens, I was out of the country. But one of my production team bravely volunteered to let them feed on her skin and filmed this unique footage.
And the first thing that you notice is it looks like a crab, and that's why they get that name, crab lice. Mm. They're very crab-like. Their bodies are much more sort of rounded, and they're much smaller as well than head lice. What it's designed to do is to live on pubic hair, and pubic hair tends to be spread slightly further apart than the hair that you get on your head. And so it's designed like this so that it can reach across and grab onto hairs that are further apart. And the hooks are a bit bigger as well, you'll notice. Mm. And that's because pubic hair tends to be thicker than most hair that you get on your head.
When scientists began to study pubic lice, they discovered something quite startling. That our pubic lice are closely related to lice found on another animal, one of the great apes.
It's thought that they came from gorillas originally, and you can see the sort of divergence between the species that are found on gorillas today and the species that we get on us around 3 million years ago.
Okay, so does that imply that we had sex, or at least our remote ancestors had sex with gorillas 3 million years ago?
I think that's probably quite a difficult one to answer, but it's probably more likely that we shared a sort of environment with gorillas. We may have even killed them to eat them as bushmeat, for example, as well. So certainly we came into contact with gorillas.
Other apes, like gorillas and chimpanzees, have a single species of louse. But when our ancestors lost thick body hair and gained pubic hair, we created two separate islands of hair, providing a niche for gorilla lice. All of which suggests we became relatively hairless at least 3 million years ago. Having two species of lice is remarkable enough, but humans actually have three. And the third species also has a secret to reveal.
There's another type of lice called the body lice, and I've got an example here to show you what an infestation looks like. And this, remarkably, is highly adapted to clothing. This was actually, I believe this was from a homeless person who had a very heavy infestation. And I think this, it looks like trousers to me with a seam here, and this is exactly where they lay their eggs.
Ah,
you can see
that is revolting.
And those eggs, so right. That is a massive infestation. It makes you feel quite itchy, doesn't it?
It does.
The body louse behaves very differently to the head louse.
So if we have a look at the lice,
but if you compare their body shapes, you see something significant.
Okay, so the one on the right, the dark one, is my friend the head louse.
Yeah.
He's looking rather dead at the moment, I have to say, not looking at all good. And the one on the left, they're the body lice, aren't they?
That's exactly right. And what you can see is that they look remarkably similar. And when you look at their DNA, what you find is that they diverged around 100,000 to 200,000 years ago. So not actually that long ago in sort of evolutionary terms, but enough to make them different species. And so that tells us something about when we as humans started to wear clothing.
So before that, the idea is humans are naked. Then they start to wear clothes. Maybe a head louse kind of drops down, thinks it's actually quite a nice place to live, and begins to evolve. A whole new species starts to evolve on clothes.
Exactly right, So it's quite incredible to think that you can look at the louse to find out more about our own ancestry and our own evolution.
So both the lice and the tapeworm have evolved to live on the human body, changing their bodies and behaviour to exploit our anatomy.
A small crowd in a city street.
But evolutionary pressure works both ways. Over time, we have also been shaped by the parasites we carry.
What do you think of those worms, gut worms?
Would it make you feel bad? Or would you be happy to have those in your tummy?
A bit bad,
yeah. Would it make you feel a bit...
Val Curtis believes that parasites have shaped some fundamental human instincts.
They get hungry, they can smell you. They can smell your warmth, and they come out maybe about 20 minutes. They spend sucking on you, and you don't even notice that they're there. And then as soon as they're...
To demonstrate, we set up a street stall to see what sort of reactions we'll get from parasites.
Which of these things do you find most disgusting?
Yeah. Oh.
What about this?
What does it do? A fly lays eggs on your skin and then it grows under your skin. That's how big they are. Can you imagine having one of those in your leg or in your head?
Val believes we evolved the disgust response to prevent us being infected with disease-causing organisms like parasites.
What about this?
Most people think of disgust as just being a bad thing, but actually disgust is incredibly good for you. Let's just imagine one of your great-great-great ancestors, and that maybe that great ancestor wasn't squeamish, and maybe that great ancestor went, oh my goodness, a poo, look, there's a bit of food left in there.
That's not, that, is yum, it? It's yum, plastic. Yum.
So maybe, you know, nibble, nibble, nibble on the poo. Now, your great ancestor who does that, is he going to find a wife easily? And not terribly well, right? Yeah. How about his children and his grandchildren? Are they going to be healthy? No, yeah. They're not. So it's a fair bet that every one of your ancestors had a good, healthy sense of squeamishness. And as a result, you have their squeamishness genes.
And it grows into something a bit like that. What do you think of that?
To reduce the risk of infection, we instinctively find parasites and anything to do with them disgusting.
The head lice. Oh.
How does that make you feel?
We've just had a haircut.
Oh, gosh.
The most likely source of parasitic infections is other human beings. For a social species like us, that presents a real dilemma.
I want to be your friend. You know, I want to learn something from you. I want to exchange with you. And all of us want to do that. That's the human way of life. We're a deeply social species. We cooperate, we exchange. But you're at the same time a bag of parasites.
Yeah.
You're absolutely stuffed full of parasites. So I don't want to get too close to you. I don't want to be within spitting distance of you. And in fact, if you look at the way people behave around the world, we don't sit too close to each other. We're very careful about wearing clean clothes. We're very careful about not being smelly and not sharing our bodily emanations. Yeah. That's good manners.
So you think the manners are a product of parasites?
Parasites teach us manners, and manners are fundamental to what make us human.
Rather than parasites.
Oddly, my reaction to having a tapeworm infection is more curiosity than disgust. To find out more, I met up with the UK's leading tapeworm expert.
OK, so it's about a week now. It's going to be about that long?
I would say so, yes. So I'm taking that as a sort of a calculation that after 10 weeks, I know it would be 3 metres. We don't really know exactly now, of course. We're just assuming that the three cysts you took were viable, and they look viable, at least two of them, I think.
How would you tell, in any way?
I don't think you will know. I think if you didn't know where you were infected, yeah, you wouldn't know.
No, I have these moments when I think I've got a little gut rot, but exactly, and I think, is that really the worm or is it not?
The fact that you know you're infected means that you might feel that you've got a bit more of a craving for beer or for carb or for chocolate or something that you like, perhaps chocolate.
No, absolutely, that's why I said to my wife.
People do report that you know they do eat more.
A tapeworm has no digestive system of its own. No mouth, no stomach, no anus. Instead, it absorbs the food I've already digested. Its skin is very similar to the inner surface of my intestines, with lots of tiny bumps called villi. These increase the surface area of the tapeworm so it can absorb nutrients directly through its skin. So what should I feed it?
It can take up carbohydrates and glycoproteins very effectively.
It likes them.
It likes them.
Anything rich in carbs will be good for the worm.
In fact, that does remind me of the type of tapeworm that you might have. It's, the proportions are fairly accurate, actually.
Yeah.
That's going to be about the width of the worm after about 10 weeks.
Yeah.
And certainly, if it's left longer than that, going into months, it will get about twice the width.
So the worm likes carbohydrate?
Well, I think it would, yes. Certainly, that's good for a growing tapeworm, Michael. if you have a bowl of that a day,
yes,
it'll grow
good and strong
to good proportions. Yeah, yeah.
A bowl of tagliatelle.
Head lice are rarely more than an irritation. And so far, my tapeworm is proving very benign. It's a strategy that makes sense. By causing minimal harm, the parasites help to ensure their host's survival.
A pebbly grey mass.
But not all parasites take this approach. An example of a lethal parasite is this one. It's a microscopic, single-celled parasite called Plasmodium. It causes malaria, a disease that kills more than 500,000 people a year.
Opening a door.
I want to find out why it is so deadly. So I've come to the National Institute of Medical Research, where they will infect my blood with Plasmodium.
To Professor Mike Blackman.
So we've got a sample of my blood here, looking
yes.
nice and red, healthy?
Yes, and warm, straight out of your body.
Hi there.
Thank you, hi.
I won't shake hands.
Thanks very much, Fiona.
Right, I guess we're not allowed in, is that right?
Oh, that's right, yes.
So what's Fiona up to at the moment?
So what she's going to do now is she's going to take a sample of Plasmodium falciparum. So this is the most dangerous form of the parasite that causes most deaths in, for example, sub-Saharan Africa. We've grown this in the lab. We can culture it continuously in human red cells. And she's now going to take a sample of those parasites and inoculate them into your blood.
Right. I must admit, of all the diseases, malaria's high on the ones I want to avoid.
you should try to avoid it if you can.
To see the malaria parasite multiplying in my blood, they're using a new photographic time-lapse technique. Although I have treated people with malaria, I have never seen the malaria parasite in action before.
Very intrigued to see what happens to my blood, but what is chilling is thinking that out there in the world, mosquitoes are infecting children, and 1,000 children every day are dying. And that's why this sort of work is so important.
Here it is, my blood infected by the deadly malaria parasite.
So the parasite goes through this life cycle in the infected red cell.
Once the infection is complete, Mike Blackman shows me the finished movie, which reveals how the parasite kills its host.
So the little white blobs here, they are the parasite, is that right?
They are the parasite, yes. So a single merozoite, this invasive form of the parasite, binds to a red cell, invades it, grows within it, digests the hemoglobin of the red cell. This is the red protein that is used to carry oxygen by your red cells. And then eventually forms around about 16 to 32 daughter merozoites.
Look at that one go. Yeah. That one just exploded, right. Didn't it?
Exactly, yes.
And so suddenly you're seeing lots and lots. Oh, wow, they're really going.
Yeah. The whole thing is destroyed in a single, very rapid process. The merozoites are released and they immediately invade a new cell. And these things just...
I had
just
no idea it was going to be that violent. I mean, that was utterly destroyed.
Each explosion obliterates one of my oxygen-carrying red blood cells and releases new parasites into my blood to infect yet more cells.
Suddenly you've gone from a situation where there are relatively few. They're everywhere, aren't they? Mm. They're just swarming. Mm. I mean, you do appreciate just what a terrible thing they're doing inside you.
Yeah, if this were going on inside you, you'd be in a pretty poor way.
You soon become anemic from lack of blood cells, and the debris from all those shattered cells can block your blood vessels, which in turn can be fatal.
So our interest here is exactly how this goes on. How does the parasite actually do that? We don't really know. The parasite is very, very good, very smart. It's evolved with its human host for a long time.
Mosquitoes.
For all parasites, getting into a new host is essential for their long-term survival. That is particularly important for parasites that kill their hosts. For Plasmodium, the key to infecting a new human host is this, the mosquito. New research has revealed that once the malaria parasite infects a mosquito, it actually sharpens its sense of smell, making the mosquito more likely to seek out and bite a human being. And as it sucks our blood, it injects the parasite into us.
A snail.
But there are other parasites that use even more extraordinary strategies for getting into a new host. Like this parasite, a kind of flatworm.
an amorphous silvery blob within a translucent disk.
Although it spends the first part of its life cycle in a snail, it needs to infect a bird in order to reproduce. To make sure the snail becomes bird food, it crawls into the snail's eye and the eye swells up to resemble a tasty caterpillar. What's more, the worm wriggles to put on a literally eye-catching show. It also changes the snail's behaviour. Usually, a snail hides in dark places. But an infected snail will happily come out into the light. This massively increases its chance of being eaten by a bird. Bad news for the snail, but great for the parasite.
Michael's watching the close-up footage on a screen.
I do find it particularly chilling, the way that the snail parasite hijacks the brain of its host and makes it give up its life for the sake of the parasite. But this is not an isolated example. There are other parasites that adopt similar strategies. This is Toxoplasma gondii. It's a microscopic parasite that looks like a wriggling comma. And it's possibly the most successful parasite on Earth. Its life always starts in a cat, where the parasite breeds.
A prowling ginger cat.
An infected cat passes oocysts, tiny capsules containing the parasites. The oocysts can survive on the ground for months, waiting to be eaten by a rat or mouse, which then becomes a carrier.
A mouse grooming itself.
But for the life cycle to complete, the parasite has to get back into a cat, which means the mouse has to be caught and eaten by a cat.
The wriggling parasites in microscopic close-up.
So Toxoplasma has to encourage its mouse host to commit suicide. A few years ago, Joanne Webster set up a series of elegant experiments to see how Toxoplasma might go about altering a rodent's behaviour, making it more likely to get eaten. She placed infected and uninfected rats in a chamber where she had liberally doused one corner with cat urine.
And we simply plopped the rat in and let them tootle about over each 4-hour, 10-hour night and simply watch where they went. Okay. Alice here is an uninfected female. She smelled the cat area and she shot off here.
She seems to be avoiding the cat.
Absolutely.
Smelling one.
So
she's hanging around in different areas.
Yep.
Putting in a rat infected with Toxoplasma produced a very different result.
This is Felix here. He's infected and he's actually in the cat zone.
Which is absolutely not what you'd expect. A normal mouse or a normal rat would run.
Smell it and absolutely
and
hide.
And he seems to be just enjoying it.
He's out, he's active, he's tootling about.
So presumably, if you're the parasite, what you want is you want the rat, Felix the rat, to hang around near where cats are because you want to be eaten.
Yes.
Joanne had shown that infected rats are attracted to cat smells. They're also generally more fearless and have slower reaction times. All these factors made them far more likely to become cat victims. What is rather disturbing is that this parasite, Toxoplasma, also infects us. Around a quarter of the British population are infected without knowing it. You can catch it from cat litter or infected soil, or from eating undercooked meat from an animal that was itself infected.
Raw meat being bagged.
Since Toxoplasma can manipulate rat brains, can the parasite also change our behaviour? There's intriguing evidence that it can.
Michael cycling.
Scientists have analysed blood samples from people involved in traffic accidents. And they found they are more than twice as likely to be infected with Toxoplasma than the average. The claim is that infected people are slower to react and take greater risks, just like infected rats.
Pulling up at the side of a bus.
I'm a keen cyclist, and I admit I've had more than my fair share of accidents.
A while ago, I was in collision with a white van and I got knocked out. More recently, I hit the curb while cycling, came off, fractured my ribs, and also broke my elbow. Now, my family thinks it's because I'm careless, reckless.
But could it be it's because I'm infected with toxoplasma? I've had a blood test to find out, and Joanne has the results.
What do you feel you are?
I would be, I guess, surprised if I wasn't, in the sense that I am aware that sometimes I do remarkably stupid things, and in retrospect, I wonder why I've done them.
So you could have a few parasites in
your brain. I wonder if there are a few. Yes. I am dying to find out, I must admit.
Joanne removes the test results from an envelope.
And you are negative.
I am negative. Okay, there. So I can't blame the parasite for my risky behaviour. I just am. It's quite scary, isn't it, the thought of a parasite manipulating your behaviour?
Absolutely, and I think the fact that it almost brings on the concepts of free will, because how much of your behaviour are you expressing is yours, and how much is it parasite within you?
Does toxoplasma change human behaviour? At the moment, there's no direct evidence. If there is an effect, it will be, in the vast majority of cases, very subtle. But the fact that it can alter a rat's behaviour is nothing short of remarkable. It shows just what extraordinary abilities evolution has equipped parasites with, to ensure they spread to a new host.
Days after infection, 11.
Tapeworm may not go in for mind control, but they do have some ingenious tricks. At 2 weeks old, my tapeworm is still a harmless youngster. But when it reaches maturity, it will start doing something rather unpleasant.
That is the adult tapeworm, and this tapeworm is exactly 10 weeks old. We know that because it was from a previous volunteer.
By 10 weeks, the mature segments are full of eggs. And they break off from the tapeworm and emerge from your body, ready to infect a cow.
So it comes out of your bottom?
It comes
out. And it can actually crawl out?
Unfortunately, yes. Psychologically, that upsets quite a few people that are infected. It can come out under its own steam, as it were. So once the segment is in the rectum, it'll move around, and that causes a sort of a strange fluttering sensation. And then it will move through the rectum, through the anus, crawl around between the buttocks, down the legs, and out onto the floor.
Right.
Can be embarrassing.
It might surprise my wife or friends.
I think it probably would, yes.
Often, the first time someone realises they are infected is when a segment crawls out. One of the reasons I'm doing this self-experiment is to help Phil change that.
I'm going to be sending you some sort of faeces samples on a weekly basis. What do you want them for?
Well, that's for us to help develop or refine a diagnostic test. Even though this worm is very big, people that are infected aren't always aware they're infected, especially early on in the infection. And we can actually take a fecal sample, a stool sample. We can test it for presence of tapeworm carbohydrates. We can also test it for tapeworm DNA. And obviously, if we find that, it suggests that the carrier, you know, does have a tapeworm infection.
Phil's research is important because tapeworm can be very dangerous. Beef tapeworm, like mine, are relatively benign. But other types, like the pork tapeworm, can form cysts in the brain, which can kill. So far, I've encountered nothing but the downside of being infected by a parasite. Yet, as we've seen, parasites come equipped with a remarkable range of skills. And sometimes we can use their skills to our advantage. This is a leech. For thousands of years, they were used to treat everything from skin diseases to fevers. Those cures almost certainly did more harm than good. But in the right hands, the leech can be a useful surgical assistant. Ian Whittaker is a reconstructive surgeon who is pioneering the modern use of leeches.
I normally use them on extremities, for example, a finger, okay, or in rare instances, a nose or an ear.
You're what, reattaching the end of a finger or something like that? Is that
yes,
right?
That's right. It is technically possible with microsurgery to attach the artery. Mm-hmm. So you've got blood flowing in, but the blood flowing out via the veins is much more difficult.
Right. So things start to swell up, does it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's the basis of it.
And the leeches are quite good at sort of controlling the flow, are they?
Yeah, it's almost as if they're custom made. you know, they remove a fairly predictable amount of blood. It's self-contained, and they promote bleeding after they're removed as well.
It's the ability to remove blood that makes the leech so useful in surgery. But how much blood can a leech consume? Well, there's one way to find out. First, we have to see how much the hungry leech weighs.
About 0.4.
That's perfect.
Okay.
So should we put it on there? Are you ready?
I'm ready, yeah.
Michael's arm.
They only need to feed once a year. It takes about 3 months to digest their blood meal.
I can feel it, yeah. Yeah. I can definitely feel something going on there.
So at the moment it's attached by its head end where the jaws and teeth will have made a hole.
Here you can see how the leech's triple-jawed mouth is able to cut through a membrane. That's what it's doing to my skin. Once it's made a hole, it can start feeding on my blood.
The leech's pulsating body.
It sucks by contracting its muscles in a rhythmic movement called peristalsis. Its digestive tract, visible here in red, can expand to hold huge quantities of blood. And its saliva contains proteins that help the blood keep flowing.
The leech on Michael's arm.
And it will be injecting some fairly ingenious things. Hirudin is probably the most important, which will prevent it clotting so it can feed more efficiently. It's the most potent anticoagulant known to man.
Yeah. I mean, how long will I go on bleeding for?
I think the average is about 12 hours. Some instances it can go up to 48 and 72 in extreme circumstances.
Oh, God, it's moved. It's come off. There you go. Oh, should we see how heavy it is? Hey, blimey, so it's now 7 or 8 times heavier.
Yeah,
that is phenomenal. I mean, on you, that would be...
That'd be equivalent of me, 115 to 120 stone after one meal.
By helping blood to flow freely into newly reattached tissues, the leech can save parts of the body that would otherwise die.
This is a very upsetting injury to lose a finger or a thumb.
Yes.
And leeches are literally the answer in some cases, when we can't get any other way to remove the blood.
Yes.
You know, so they literally will save people's careers.
The growing use of leeches in surgery has led to unusual business opportunities. Leech breeding. I've come to visit the UK's only leech farm.
So how many leeches do you have here?
It's about 35,000 at the moment, and it goes up to about 70,000.
Wow. I mean, I wouldn't have imagined there was a world demand for 70,000 leeches.
So how do you go about farming leeches?
These are breeding chambers. Mm-hmm. The leeches in the wild, they would breed in water, and they come up onto land to lay their eggs.
OK. So this is kind of like a swamp, isn't it?
Like a swamp, yeah. You can see there's a freshly laid cocoon there.
Each cocoon contains 25 tiny baby leeches.
There we go. Ooh, they're a bit nasty, aren't they?
Oh, I know. Never tire of the miracle of birth.
Yeah.
Tiny leeches drop into a jar of water.
Most of the leeches here are of a species called Haruda verbena. But they also have another, significantly larger species of leech that normally feeds on Southeast Asian water buffalo.
We tend to use this species mainly for veterinary use.
Will it bite?
Ah, that is unpleasant. Ah, that is so unpleasant.
That really freaked me in ways I wasn't expecting. No.
Funnily enough, I found that buffalo leech much more disgusting than swallowing the tapeworm cyst. It's now over 3 weeks since I did so, and the worm should be at least a foot long. But it still isn't causing me any problems.
I haven't
you know, just any stomach upsets, perhaps a little bit more craving for sugar. Definitely feel the urge for chocolate and biscuits, but that's also completely normal. So absolutely no side effects, apart from dreaming on one occasion that I had all these little things coming out of my bottom. Nocturnal emissions, but when I woke up I was relieved they weren't there.
Yellow tapeworm strands.
A bacterial gut infection will often cause diarrhea and stomach pains, and yet I feel nothing. To find out why, I met up with Helena Helmby, who studies how worms interact with our immune system.
You have a very fine collection of worms here. I mean, some of them I recognise, tapeworm. This one I'm less familiar with.
This is the Ascaris. This is the large round worm.
The thing that puzzles me is how do these worms evade the human immune system? Because, I mean, some of them are huge.
Yes. And we have a very, very sophisticated immune system, which is constantly on watch, guarding against any microorganism 24/7. But these large parasites have actually developed a very sophisticated way of dealing with our immune system, because they have evolved with us for thousands, if not millions of years.
The worms have evolved mechanisms to dampen down our immune responses by secreting compounds that manipulate our immune system. That enables the worms to survive, but may also have benefits for us.
The worms are allowed to stay because the immune system realizes that the attack to kill them would be far too dangerous, really, for the host. Obviously, you don't want a massive inflammatory response in your intestine, because that would cause a lot of damage to your intestine, and that would be dangerous for you as a host. So there's some sort of an uneasy truce between the worm and the host in this case.
It is extraordinary, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely fantastic.
You're a fan, eh?
Yes, I love them.
So, our bodies have evolved a kind of ceasefire with the worms. But in a modern technological society, most people spend their lives worm-free. Some scientists believe this may have contributed to the rise of allergies. It's known as the hygiene hypothesis.
So you buy the idea, do you, that one of the reasons we have this huge surge in allergies is because we're just not exposed to as many worms or microorganisms as we used to be?
It's quite possible, because that particular arm of the immune system that reacts when we get a strong allergic reaction to grass pollen or something like that is also the same arm of the immune response that we use to fight parasites. And of course, if we are now not having these parasites, perhaps that part of the immune system doesn't really know what to do with itself, and it sort of goes off and reacts badly to innocuous allergens, such as grass pollen or cat dandruff or whatever it is you're allergic to.
So perhaps having a worm inside you will help control your immune system and keep it in balance. It's not proven, but the evidence is intriguing. There's no doubt that there has been a huge rise in allergies and so-called autoimmune diseases as we've got richer and more hygienic. And rates of these diseases are highest in countries that don't have lots of parasitic worms.
Michael enters an Indian restaurant.
But what's controversial is that some people are now using worms to try and treat their diseases. Daniel Heyman has Crohn's.
I got ill.
It's a debilitating condition in which the immune system in the gut starts attacking the body's own tissues.
I was in Australia, travelling with my parents. I was very ill the whole time I was there, but it wasn't diagnosed till I got back, by which point I'd lost several stone in weight, and I was bleeding internally, and so it was pretty serious. And it took me a while to kind of work out what I could eat and what I couldn't. Curry wasn't on the menu at all, no. I was limited to sort of fish, rice, very plain food, certain fruits, bananas I could eat. I had also a problem with my lips, so they started sort of crusting up, which is another symptom of Crohn's disease.
Right.
The immune system sort of attacks the whole digestive tract.
A tiny vial.
Fed up with the side effects from the drugs, Daniel turned to an unconventional treatment, hookworm. These little blood-sucking parasitic worms live in the intestines. Daniel hoped they would suppress his gut's immune system for their own survival, and by doing so, reduce his symptoms. Daniel ordered a tube of live hookworm on the internet and placed them on his skin, where they burrowed in, eventually finding their way into his guts. That was 2 years ago.
How quickly did you notice changes?
It was a gradual process over about a year, I think. Probably, I realised that I didn't have to use the cream on my lips. That was a real realisation that, like, you know, some kind of change had taken place.
Were you spooked by the idea of having a parasite inside you?
I wasn't, you know. I think human beings are designed, actually, to have some kind of parasites in them. It's part of modern life that we're so clean that we don't have any. But if you were living in a natural environment, the way, you know, in a situation that our bodies have evolved to live in,
yes,
then you would have some kind of parasites going through you. I'm just going to try this.
Do you have any fear of food at the moment?
No, I mean, I'm really free. Like, thanks to the worms.
Yes.
I am basically free to eat as anyone else would.
Outside.
Now, Daniel certainly makes a really compelling case for hookworm. I just wish there were some proper clinical trials that would support what he's doing, because there is always the risk that he happens to be exceptional, and also a risk that the hookworm might make your symptoms worse. But I'm very pleased it's worked for him. Helena Helmby, like most scientists, finds the idea of self-infection very troubling.
I mean, scientists have worked now for over 100 years trying to eradicate these diseases, and now we want to start to reintroducing them into people again. I mean, these worms actually live in the gut, and they suck blood from your intestinal mucosa. And they move around a lot as they do that, so they cause a lot of bleeding. And if you have a high dose of hookworm in your gut, you will become anemic quite quickly. Rather than infecting people with human parasites, we should be really looking into purifying these molecules that the worms produce and turn them into drugs, turn them into worm pills.
5 weeks after Michael's infection.
The hope is that these studies will lead to new treatments for some of modern life's most debilitating conditions.
An illustration of a tapeworm.
My tapeworm, if it's there, has certainly been living in harmony with my body. 6 weeks on, and I still can't feel a thing. Of course, there is the possibility that the worm isn't there, that none of the three cysts survived.
The flashing, clear-domed end of a pill capsule.
The best way to find out is using this. A miniature camera, which you swallow.
Stuart Blythe.
Okay, and I'm just going to place this on the front of your abdomen. And now I'm going to attach the data recorder.
Okay.
So that just plugs into the side here. So in your own time,
okay,
if you want to swallow the capsule.
Never previously used, I'm assuming.
Never previously used. Down the hatch.
Michael swallows it with water.
Right, I think that's gone. Oh, blimey.
There's
my stomach. That is weird, isn't it? There you go. Live from my stomach.
Michael's insides displayed on a tablet screen.
And somewhere in the small intestines, the worm lurking, we hope. It's going to be quite strange to come face to face with it, so to speak.
Before I can see the worm, I need to wait for the pill camera to pass out of my stomach and into my guts.
So let's see where it's got to. It's still in the stomach, so it's hanging around a bit.
It's not until the evening that the pill finally moves into my intestines.
Ah! That is it. That is the tapeworm. You can see it. Oh, God, that is horrible. You can just see its tail and its segments waving around. I don't know if I'm absolutely disgusted or I'm actually quite excited. Wow. But it would have been hugely disappointing to have gone all the way to Kenya, come back and seen nothing. But what's amazing is I've not experienced anything and yet you can see it there. I mean, that is so weird.
Right. I wonder if I'm going to sleep tonight. I'm dying to go back and show it to my wife, see what she makes of it.
The pill camera's view.
This footage provides scientists with a rare chance to see a live worm in its natural habitat. So we sent the complete video to a team at Salford University.
Just at the back there, you can just see the worm, the thinnest part of the worm. This is the sort of the front end. The segments are getting more mature as you're moving down the length of the intestine here. They're getting bigger, coming sexually mature. Probably they're starting to get fertilization taking place, so the worm is actually starting to reproduce at this stage.
Can you tell at this point how big it is? I had no idea of the scale.
By the looks of this, it's certainly over a metre in length.
So a metre?
Yeah, certainly a couple of feet, probably 3 to 4 feet in length,
right,
by this stage.
One of those.
So this is the end of that worm. So it's worthwhile having a look further down the intestine to see what's there.
Right.
Travelling further down the intestine, the pill camera makes a startling discovery.
Oh!
Ah. That's another worm, yeah?
You have more than one worm, definitely. Yes.
Right. And so will it be competing with the other worm for nutrition?
They are definitely in a different place, and it's quite possible that they are trying to avoid being in the same place so that they're not competing with each other. There is a lot of nutrients in the intestine, but the worms may well space themselves out deliberately so that they can get the most out of what you've been eating.
I'm quietly thrilled. Slightly disgusted, but quietly thrilled, I must admit.
I'll stop there.
OK.
And guess what? You've got three worms.
Oh, blimey.
This is the very front end, the head end. This is the bit that attaches onto the intestine. There are actually four muscular suckers around that sort of head end. Those are what's latching onto the wall of your intestine and keeping the worm in place. It
Wow. Like 100% hit rate. I have to say, a very successful experiment.
With three worms inside me, I definitely don't want the segments crawling out. Time to treat my infection.
Dr. Mike Brown.
Generally with worm infections, a single dose of a medication does the job. And so you're going to take those four tablets with some water.
All four?
All four of them.
OK, down the hatch. Goodbye, worm.
Michael swallowing a pill, then pill camera footage.
The pills kill the worms, which are then absorbed by my gut. A suitably ironic end. Parasites digested by their host.
It has been absolutely eye-opening spending quality time with parasites and discovering their ingenious strategies. From the relatively benign beef tapeworm to the frequently lethal malaria parasite. The subtle manipulative skills of Toxoplasma to the full-on assault of the leech. But above all, I have learned enormous respect for these extraordinary creatures, and in future I will think twice before using the word parasite simply as a form of abuse.